Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
That kid is back on the escalator again.
Pain don't hurt.
Is my boomstick.
Game over, man. Game over.
Welcome to the Bargain Bin. He is your host, Ben Mason.
And he is your co-host, Sandro Luketic. And today we're talking 2006's Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. Again, I say this a lot, Sandro, but I assume you have never heard of or had seen this film.
You would be very accurate in that, sir. I had never heard of this movie.
I love that. I totally love it because I do know some people hate this film, but I think it's a hidden gem. So I really was curious, knowing your sense of humor, how you yourself would take this, because I didn't know if it would go hardcore, I love this, hardcore, I hate this, but I don't believe it would be right down the middle.
So hardcore, okay.
Hardcore, fantastic. That's my prediction.
Okay. All right.
Not saying that's how I feel. I'm just saying that's my prediction for you.
Okay. You're entitled to make a prediction and see what that gets you.
So, you know, you knew nothing whatsoever going into this film.
I needed you to clarify multiple times after we stopped recording last week what the name was.
Okay, good. Very good. I don't think I can tell you the first time I saw this movie. I don't remember it. It was a long time ago. I'm guessing I might have just found it on the shelf of the video store I was working at the time.
It's pretty common, pretty typical answer.
But before I get into the movie more, obviously it is time to play your game.
Yes.
And I think I've nailed it this time.
Okay. It's pretty much 1.5.
Shit.
Okay.
I had 1.
Okay.
Wait, no. No, I have it. I fucking have it.
Okay, well, stop teasing us. What is it?
Number 1, Kane Hodder.
Okay. Well, that's a half, but yeah.
That's a half?
Well, yeah. Like, his appearances were cameos in both this movie and the movies he was in, so.
Yeah, so it was definitely the 2 Adam Green movies we covered.
Correct.
Yeah, so Hatchet and Frozen.
Yes, correct.
And then I would say Robert Englund.
That is correct.
Never Too Young to Die.
Uh-huh.
There was another one, wasn't there?
Uh-huh.
Well, I fucked myself.
Oh, you were so confident, man.
I was very confident. What else?
I guess you could say you were sleeping on this game.
No. Hatchet.
He was a short scene in Hatchet, yes.
There's another?
Well, think of the hint that I just gave you.
Sleeping.
Oh, come on, man.
Oh, yeah, we did do Nightmare on Elm Street, didn't we?
Oh!
Do you know why that came to mind?
I don't know.
Because of Johnny Depp.
Huh?
Because I forgot that Johnny Depp was in that movie when we covered him.
Okay.
And that just made me think, Nightmare on Elm Street, Robert Englund. I completely missed Johnny Depp last time we played this. I think it was when we covered him, Secret Window was the last time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot he was in that movie. So there's more. Don't tell me there's more.
No, there isn't. I'm just surprised that Johnny Depp is the reason you remembered Nightmare on Elm Street right now.
Well, he's the epitome of me embarrassing myself because I forgot him in a movie where I praised his acting and his presence.
Yeah, but those things aren't mutually exclusive. You can forget the movie that we covered and still think that his acting was phenomenal in it.
I know, but in my mind, I'm like, I'm Johnny Depping this one real bad. Especially when he was in Nightmare on Elm Street. Oh my god, Nightmare on Elm Street.
There you go. I'm surprised, like, it's Robert Englund, and I said you're sleeping on it. Feel like that should have come immediately to mind, but, okay.
So I got it.
Yes, that is all of them.
Damn, I'm good at this game. I nailed it again.
I mean, yes, you are.
That is correct. So let's jump into Behind the Mask.
Sounds good. The documentary about the making of the Jim Carrey movie.
I mean, I would watch that.
Oh, totally. But it might even be funnier than the actual movie.
There's no way that would be true. But we have to say, before getting into the notes of the movie, this is a film that absolutely needs to be watched twice. By your silence, I assume you disagree.
I have no comment.
There are so many hints dropped throughout the beginning of this film and the middle, which really work at the end of the movie if you didn't pick up on every single little thing that you saw in first viewing, that with a rewatch adds extra enjoyment to this movie. And I say it's a job well done by Glosserman, the director. For me, he extended the enjoyment of a 90-minute movie twofold. So well done. I had seen this a long time ago. I knew the twist. I knew the turn. But watching it again and catching only a few little things was great. Watching it again to do notes for the film and catching even more. There's so much to enjoy about this movie. So many subtle little things that I think a lot of people who only watch this once are going to completely miss out on.
Okay. I do want to point out for people that are maybe a little skeptical, when you get the Eureka moment, there will be a number of things that you go back on. So it's not like you'll be completely devoid of it.
True. No, you will catch some things, but they do a very good job at hinting what's happening throughout the entire film. So getting into it, we open on a restaurant worker, Kelly, taking out the garbage. Your standard jump scare of a person in the background watching her, but he's gone when she turns around. And the back door of the diner slamming shut and Kelly just flees. So right away, we're setting up horror tropes.
This is reminiscent to the first Friday the 13th? No. Which one was it that started with the diner? The second one, right?
Yeah, the store. Yeah.
Okay, fair.
With the married couple that hate each other.
A little bit more entertaining than this, of course. but this scene of, like you described, somebody watching in the bushes. She thinks she catches something out of the back of her eye, turns around, and they're gone. It's such a cliche way to start that I'm not going to lie. I kind of rolled my eyes when it began.
I thought you would.
Well, cause
I really did.
It's just like, okay, so you're just doing the exact same movie. Okay. But it's a perfect way to just get your like expectations diverted, because this is not what you get after that.
No. In fact, we even have a return to it later, which makes it even more enjoyable.
Oh, yeah.
But we meet our lead, Taylor, who's making a documentary on slashers. And what I loved immediately is that in this world, the world of Behind the Mask, Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers are all real people.
Yeah. I'm surprised they're all in it, the same movie, right? Like, would there not be some licensing issues with referencing all of them?
I don't know how they got around it, but they did, and I love it. Can you imagine living in that world?
No.
Where supernatural slashers are real. It would be so terrifying.
Not just supernatural slashers, but just regular people that are clearly copying them. Yeah. You would never feel safe in this world, ever.
No. And that's the thing, too, because we get a cameo by Kane Hodder in, oh my God, I forget the name of the town where Nightmare is set, but in that town. Then we see in Haddonfield, the existence of Michael Myers has completely destroyed the practice of trick-or-treating on Halloween.
Kids just sitting there looking outside the window. But that also makes you wonder, like, well, why'd you get dressed up for that?
That's all they can do to celebrate Halloween.
I disagree. Like, they could have, like, games and stuff inside, but I guess looking out the window is more of a message-sending image.
It's much more effective, yes. Yeah.
It'd be very, very different impact if they were just inside wearing costumes, but having a blast with friends and bobbing for apples and playing games.
Yeah. These killers are real, but honestly, things are pretty great still.
This is just what we call the COVID impact on Halloween.
Oh my God, it is. COVID, the ultimate slasher.
Yeah. It's got a higher body count.
I mean, that's dark.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're correct. Taylor's documentary, she's focusing on Leslie Vernon, someone possessed by evil as a child, abducted by an angry mob, and thrown over a waterfall, but somehow, legend has it, he survived. Then we get the reveal of Leslie Vernon for the documentary. And I have to ask you, Sandro, what do you think about this guy?
So my opinions of this guy changed drastically during the course of the movie.
Perfect. That's fine.
I'm not exactly sure how to express this without getting into the future thoughts. But like, at first I'm like, who's this goober?
Yeah. I didn't say it at the beginning of the episode like I normally do, but we will spoil things. So feel free, man. Get into it if you want to now, or you can wait.
No, I'd rather wait. Because I'd rather get into how my thoughts on him changed. But yeah, like, initially it was like, how is this guy going to be a killer? This guy's just like, is he going to give your computer a virus? Come on.
Yeah. He's so weird, but really fun. And I found him really likable.
Oh, he's so likable.
But I do remember specifically the first time I saw this, he reminded me of Dane Cook.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that irritated me. I did not get that this time around. But yeah, he is very strange, like showing the documentary crew his turtles.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But like not wanting them to touch one because it will bite, but the other one's fine. And they're playing with the turtles, and he just lets out the one line of, I only keep pets I can eat.
That's exactly the line I was thinking of.
But then just switch right over. Everyone's pretty stoked. Well, I say everyone. Taylor is pretty stoked about his library, his textbooks, manuals. They're all things that can make him be a better killer. So he even says, like, it's David Copperfield, it's Houdini, sleight of hand, escape tactics. And I'm wowed by the writing here. It's very fun.
I liked how when they were like going to meet him, they were giving you these like very cliche like moments of you know, like trying to find the killer kind of thing. Like they look in the window. I don't know what the term I'm looking for is here, you know, like same thing, like they catch the corner of their eye, they see the killer looking out at them in the window, and they go to the shed, and they like, it's like they're investigating the killer, but they were actually invited. So it's really, really weird.
Going back to something you had said earlier, this kind of filmmaking, it makes me wonder if the focus of the film alienates anyone watching who isn't a fan of slasher films.
Well, I don't know why you would watch this if you're not a slasher fan, though.
Well, that's just it. I can see it losing a lot of viewers, unfortunately. Maybe people have just wanted to throw in a horror film because no one's putting this in the comedy section of stores. I don't think if you look it up online, it will say comedy, maybe mockumentary, horror. But there is so much humor in this until the last third that I think it could have turned a lot of horror fans off.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the magic trick he does with the deck of cards?
I actually really enjoyed that. Because you're like, this guy's so lame, but he's going to do a card trick or whatever. And then he planted the card on them. That's the trick. It was so good.
Yeah. And it just shows that this man is a master of planning things way in advance.
Yeah. Little subtle hints. Like, this guy is two steps ahead of you.
It is such a wonderful clue. And I think it's one of those little examples I was talking about before about how you're probably going to forget about that by the time we get to the end of the film. But the writer-director is telling you up front, like, you're being worked. You're being tricked this entire time.
Mm-hmm.
So Leslie's explanation of why he does what he does, when asked anyway, I love that he just says it's too vast of a topic to explain. And the real understanding is found in the reaction of the people involved. So it kind of shuts down the conversation, but it should be making the viewer question what exactly was just said there, because that does play out as well. So we go from the why. What about the how? Then we go through the steps.
There's a lot of steps.
I wasn't really a fan of the steps. Were you?
I was still very unsure still what was going on.
Really? Okay.
Which maybe is a good thing for this moment of the movie, because I am a little bit disarmed by my curiosity. Because not just the fact that this is going on, but at the same time, you're like, this is a world where, like, not only do these people exist, but they're so okay with it, they're doing a documentary on it. Like, like, we're not even trying to hide it. Not only do these people exist, but they're out in the open about it. What is going on here?
Yeah, it's weird because everything's been normalized.
Yep.
At what point were you like, okay, I think I'm on board to watch the rest of this or experience the rest of this and not question everything that's happening, be so on the edge of, am I liking this? Am I not? Do I want to continue? Do I not?
Last week when you said we were covering this movie.
Oh, great. That's awesome. Thank you for that
one. What, you expect us to do an episode where I'm like, yeah, I got 20 minutes in and I checked out, man.
I mean, if you did, that would be okay. That's a conversation right there.
Not for our podcast.
Well, you know, I'd just rip on you for the next hour.
Oh, sure. But I wouldn't have enough to go an hour. Yeah, that 20 minutes I watched, that was something.
So when were you like, okay, I know what's going on here?
I'm an idiot. I didn't catch on until very late in the movie.
Okay.
If you're referring to him working them.
Yeah, honestly, I don't remember how long it took me the first time I saw it.
Well, how could you? You probably saw it a long time ago.
Yeah, it was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But I knew it going into it this time, so I was expecting it, and I really enjoyed it because of that. But yeah.
Let me answer a different type of question that you didn't ask, but might attribute to this. For somebody who's not doing it for the purpose of a podcast, I will say that I was already at the point in this movie where I was okay with what I thought the movie was going to be. Because initially, I didn't know, am I actually watching a slasher? I didn't know. Like, I have never heard of the movie. And then when I put it on and I'm like, okay, so this is kind of like a mockumentary about it. At this point in the movie, I was already fully on board. And if I wasn't doing it for the review, I probably would have been watching because I had settled into that mentality.
Like, this is the Spinal Tap of horror films.
Yes. Like, I'd actually gotten to the point where I was like, okay, so this is a comedy about horror thrillers. And I was okay with that.
I would be okay with that, too. If there was no twist, that would be great. But step one, on the anniversary of his death, the town kids dare each other to stay at his old farmhouse. And on this specific anniversary, he's going to show up. Now, that sounds threatening, but this guy just seems so lovable.
There's only one flaw in that to me, in that how does he set up them daring each other to stay there on the anniversary? He plans everything else, and here we're just like, okay, that happens. And it's like, well, how does he react to it? Okay, well, why did the kids decide to do that?
And I have a theory on that.
Ooh, I'd like to hear it.
Which goes into spoiler territory, but like I said, you have to expect that in this conversation. I think Leslie Vernon was a real person. Now, the Leslie Vernon we're dealing with here is not Leslie Vernon. He's Leslie Mancuso. So I think he heard the story, knew about what kids are doing, and decided he's adopting that moniker so he can then join the ranks of these famous slashers.
Okay, yeah. So in part of his scouting, he would have had to find a place where they were already doing that legend and staying there.
Exactly. Now, earlier you said he's two steps ahead of everyone. If one step was finding a group of people to kill, this would be the second step. or switch those. The first step, yeah. Finding the lore. Second, finding the kids.
Exactly.
But like I said, he's just so lovable. Like when Taylor asks why he doesn't live there, he gives a legit reason. It's like, then they'd know where to find me. And he just laughs it off and playfully like shoves her on the shoulder, pushing her out of frame, which I thought was funny.
It's so good too, because she's at this point, like, physical contact. I don't know if I'm comfortable with this. She kind of like slouches her shoulder away from him. And you see this progression during the movie as she gets more and more comfortable with him.
Oh yeah. She definitely warms up to him. Same with Todd and Doug. Eventually, like the camera guys, like, eventually they kind of become this pseudo family. It's really interesting. But then we get the inclusion of the apple orchard, which kind of feels like it should be the perfect setting for a slasher film. You know, the story of goat into the orchard on the night of a harvest moon and till the soil and the dirt will come up wet with blood. You can still hear Leslie's mother's body swinging in the trees. But this is all just one big joke that he's playing on his new friends.
Friends, eh?
And it, quote, friends.
Not yet.
No. Short cardio training montage with a heavy bag, which I thought was absolutely hilarious.
Oh, so good.
And it addresses a complaint you had numerous times with slasher films, and that is how, when everyone's running away from the killer and the killer's just walking, how does he catch up to
them? All the time. This originally started when my friend Mike, who was on our episode for Money Plane, and I started watching like horror movies as kids to laugh at how bad they are. We rented Pumpkinhead. And every time you see Pumpkinhead, he's going at the slowest pace you could possibly imagine. And they're in a car. And then the next thing you know, it cuts and he's in front of them. It's like, how? How did you get there?
Yeah, and even Leslie does that in this, but he said that there's a whole thing of making it look like you're walking when everybody else is running their asses off, and you have to be ready for that. You have to build your cardio for that.
He's specifically training for it.
Yeah. Step two, find a target group of kids. It seems random, but it is planned. And the girl is the key, but needs a supporting cast. Brilliant. Because that is indeed what happens in every movie. And that is what happens very quickly here. The supporting cast is just kind of attached to the girl who we don't even really get, quote, get, until the final act of the film.
Yeah.
But we do get the explanation of the final girl. Or they call them survivor girls in this, which I find strange.
I can't imagine that final girl is like trademarked.
It was a term that originates from the book Men, Women, and Chainsaws, which is a very, very good book. I highly recommend. Anybody who's curious about the idea of gender in the modern horror film, check this book out. I think it's from like 1992. I haven't read it in a long time, but it is very good. Cut to that night in the parking lot of the restaurant or diner. And Leslie points out that his final girl, Kelly Curtis, who we saw at the beginning of the film, is the target now. So step three, Leslie calls the flyby. And this is just the opening of the film again.
I'm still a little confused. This isn't like a callback that we're just seeing the first scene from a different angle, or are they doing it a second night?
No, it is the exact scene from the beginning of the film.
Okay, so what we're seeing right now is essentially like, or what we saw at the beginning of the film was a little bit of a flash forward to this part?
Yeah, so now we're seeing how they got the opening scene to play out the way it did.
Yes, and he even got them to help, which is a nice little touch. Start small, okay? You're going to be the one that kicks like the doorstop out of the way, but you're still getting a little bit warmer and a little bit closer.
Exactly. And after all of this, the documentary crew are so pumped and Leslie's so happy. They're all kind of celebrating together. Like, it's also a beat. There's cheers, fist bumps, elbows, hugs. And then we get something that you brought up before, like seeing something out of the corner of your eye, being like, what's that? There's a brief, who's that shady guy reference as he's somebody who runs past in the distance. I don't know if you caught that or not, but this is our pseudo introduction to Doc Halloran.
I did catch the person running by. I didn't catch who it was.
I don't think you're supposed to.
Yeah, my brain did not go back to that one.
Next up, I think will be one of your favorite parts. It's definitely one of mine. It's time to meet married couple Jamie and Eugene. I know Eugene, played by Scott Wilson, as Herschel from The Walking Dead. I don't know if you recognized him from anything.
Walking Dead, yes, but I feel like there was something else. I don't know.
There's always a lot more. That was the first one that came to mind for me.
Yeah, he's pretty well versed. He's got a lot on his resume.
I know I've seen a lot of his roles. But what are your thoughts on these two?
I gotta say, I'm not overly fond.
Wow.
Like, I like really? Scott Wilson. I guess the idea of a mentor is not bad, but there's a little too much of a zany cuteness to the relationship they have. I don't know. If it didn't feel like it fit the theme that well.
I loved it. They're so welcoming and friendly. It feels like the personification of the idea of the perfect marriage. Like, they both support each other. They love each other. They're outgoing, focused on each other's likes. I mean, Eugene, when we first see him, he's out back in the tank. The tank is what? A sensory deprivation tank that's buried in the ground? And the whole time...
He's in a coffin. Come on. Let's not get ourselves.
Yeah, no, that's what they call it, though. But yes, it is a coffin. And yeah, Jamie's just like, oh, he's just out back in the tank. And the whole point of it is to help control bodily functions to appear that you're dead. And they uncover him and wake him up. And he thinks it's Tuesday, but it's Thursday.
Yeah, he's been in there a while.
I love that. Because, like, well, that just justifies the opening of Friday the 13th, Part 6, when Jason was buried in the graveyard for so long, and then lightning hits him. It just wakes him up. He was fine the whole time.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's what they were going for in that one, but...
No, I know. I totally know. Just bullshitting.
Nailed it.
I guess in original... ideas or the original script, Eugene was meant to be Billy from Black Christmas. I don't think you've seen those movies.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, basically just a killer living in the attic. But he even, like, in the attic of a sorority house. And he references that too. But they changed it through rewrites. I think it would have been great, but you don't need it. I get that.
I understand what they're doing with these people in trying to show that, like, oh, yeah, they're really nice people. They're just doing a job. But it just seems so off.
Oh, okay. Because this totally worked for me. Like, after Eugene has a shower or whatever, Leslie's like, hey there, old timer, how you doing? And yeah, Eugene's a retired slasher, which I think is an amazing concept. But how was it so off for you? Because everything here hit for me.
I don't know. I cannot describe it. It's just a feeling that this doesn't make sense to me.
Too much comedy?
Yeah, maybe like they lean too heavily into the idea that they're trying to go for here, and that like they're trying to make it, you know, a lot more commonplace, and that it's a touch of normality in the world. But I don't know. It was just a lot.
Yeah, I say it's nice and wholesome. It does lean towards being overly wholesome, which just... it does kind of seem weird. I just enjoyed it. But then we do balance it out a bit more when Taylor's asking Eugene questions as he's cutting up vegetables. He gets so worked up talking about how downhill slashes have fallen that by the time he's done slicing these carrots, they're basically mush.
Yeah, it cuts back to it a few times and it's like, oh, it's cut finer. It's cut finer. And now it's just a paste.
Yeah. And I have to keep reminding myself that we're supposed to be viewing this as a documentary. And if you're doing that, this is very unnerving. So, finding out that Kelly spends time at the library, Eugene convinces Leslie to kill the librarian to add to Kelly's fear and build tension. This gets a bit muddled for me, I have to say, because the next step is getting Kelly to read an article about the person who raped Leslie's mother. This person is Kelly's great uncle, but it's a fake story. She doesn't have a great uncle, at least not this person. And this is just a CG image to make like a family likeness, I guess, between the two.
Yeah, it's like to build a connection to make her feel more involved. I don't know.
Yeah, I get what they were going for. It just seems too over the top, especially for 2006. So the crew follows him into the library that night. And what happens next? Reading the fake microfiche seems way too convenient. Leslie swapping them out, like, that's, there's too many moving parts for this to work for me.
I mean, that's a sentiment for a lot of the movie. Because you also need the librarian to be involved with that to say, hey, let's go look at the microfiche.
Yes.
Not to say that, oh, it's so outlandish that they would have done that. But yeah, there, it's just like with the whole, you know, what I was kind of going on earlier, like they also need kids to be daring them to sleep at the house. Like, it just, too many things need to fall into place. But if you're taking it as just like the Spinal Tap of, you know, horror movies, then it's just like, okay, yeah, I'm okay with that. Fine. They can be flaws. This is just about jokes.
Yeah, but at the same time, there seems to be a sentiment of how long are we going to go through this setup before we get some sort of payoff? Because it already feels a little drawn out to me.
Okay, well, you can definitely think that.
There is one part here that I really enjoyed, though, and it harkens to what you were saying before. At one point, Leslie whispers to the documentary crew, "It's going to get wet in here tonight, kiddies." And I'm like, that's a gross statement, first and foremost.
Well, he is a very charming but awkward character.
Yeah. But did you notice Taylor's expression?
No.
She has a big smile on her face. So I feel like this is the point where Taylor is fully on board with this documentary. She no longer feels awkward around him. She's just happy to be getting this footage. But you can also ask, is she sold or is she swayed? Because she does wish him luck. So is she being won over by his personality, or is she so happy with what she's actually getting for her documentary that she just wants to see it through?
Yeah, it's all about her work, you know? She just wants to get that award for journalism.
You know who doesn't care about awards? Todd.
Todd's great. You don't even see Todd is, for the majority of
Todd is horny as fuck filming Kelly in the library.
I forget what the other cameraman's name is because he's not Todd.
Doug.
But he's just like, come on, man, she's a teenager. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, Doug's the voice of reason.
What? We get a great... Oh, yeah, Doug, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, Todd. We'll go with Todd.
Todd is absolutely not the voice of reason.
That's going to make us look real good to anyone listening. But the librarian, we get an awesome cameo because Mrs. Collinwood is played by Zelda Rubinstein, or Stein, depending on how you pronounce it. I know her from mainly Poltergeist. So good. And, of course, their plan has to work perfectly. Collinwood tells Kelly the story. So, yeah, Leslie's supposed to be related to her. He killed the great uncle and hanged his own mother in the apple orchard. And then townsfolk threw him over the waterfall. Honestly, it's not a bad slasher origin story. But what doesn't make sense is Leslie just planted all this info. And if Mrs. Collinwood is so aware and knowledgeable about the scenario, she would realize that that picture is not real. That's the one big flaw in this for me.
She's not going to know 100% of it.
I guess. She seems pretty apt, pretty up to snuff on her knowledge of this murder. But yeah, so much happens in the scene following this. Colin was straight up murdered by Leslie. The reveal of Leslie's costume, his killer garb, if you will. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say you hate it.
I'm not a fan.
I am also not a fan.
It's a little lacking in detail, and it doesn't really stand out too much on its own.
I think it looks absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the mask. I hate the overalls. I hate the weird fake hair coming out of the back of the mask. It doesn't work for me.
I think the only thing I do like is that they show us that he does his makeup underneath so that you can't see like in the cracks of the like mask or something like that. But
yeah,
that's not enough.
No, but I mean, it was impactful because it went on to inspire Pattinson in the Batman.
Okay. Right.
We also get the reveal of Robert Englund as Doc Halloran. I want to know your thoughts on this character, but to me, right away, it's 100% Dr. Loomis from Halloween.
I don't know, man. I'm not that familiar with Dr. Loomis, so I can't say, oh, yeah, that's who I thought of. My reaction when I saw this character was like, ah, nice, Robert Englund.
Yeah, but how about more so like in Jason Goes to Hell? I forget his name, but I remember him as the captain in 21 Jump Street.
Oh, Adam Fuller. Or he was
yes.
Stephen Williams, but he was Adam Fuller in 21 Jump Street.
Yes. So Stephen Williams is basically the Doc Halloran, but for Jason Goes to Hell.
Okay.
A lot of slasher films have that character who kind of comes out of nowhere, is mysterious, but you know you're supposed to side with them because they're going after the killer. They're obviously, there's some sort of connection between the two, and we'll figure out what it is as the movie progresses.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie and crew flee the scene and celebrate elsewhere because Leslie is stoked that he finally has an Ahab. Now, my next note just says, Sandra, what's an Ahab? But I just explained it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Someone who will defend people at great personal risk. But there is a personal vendetta going on here as well. Do you remember the aftermath of this scene? Kind of like the dress down scene?
No.
Back at Jamie and Eugene's. Where they're freaking out about Jamie or about Leslie being shot.
Yeah, Leslie's totally fine with it, but
yeah, he shot you, right? He's like, yeah, right in the shoulder. It's fine. I was wearing a vest. Like, this guy's perfect. He's planning everything to a T and everyone's so happy. Now, tell me if you disagree.
Okay.
But I think they're pumping so much positivity and humor and wholesomeness into these interactions to win us over that much more. So the final third of the movie, the final act, is a bit more shocking.
Because
I think it worked on me. It didn't work on you, though. I find that interesting.
We'll see.
So Taylor and the documentary crew decide to go to the diner and interact with Kelly, but Halloran notices what they're doing and confronts them.
What a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea.
There's no way this is a good idea.
Even Leslie tells them, don't do this.
Yeah, it's a stupid idea.
I don't know what they expected to get out of it, though. Extra footage? Did they really want to confront her and like interview her? Because that would just ruin everything.
Personal curiosity? I don't know what they were thinking here.
Because you're not hiding that camera.
No.
There's no way. Even Halloran sees it from across the diner. So yeah, he does storm over and ask what they're doing, what they think they're doing there. Basically tells them that Leslie Vernon is Leslie Mancuso from Nevada, and Halloran treated him at an institution. Now, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, this might be the first acknowledgement that this film is much darker than we've been led to believe.
Yeah, because even the scenes in the library, they're already trying to get kills going, and they're not that dark.
Yeah. At all.
Yeah.
And why does it take Kelly approaching the table for them to freak out and leave? Like, as soon as you see Halloran coming at you, you're like, fuck this, shut it down, we're out of here. But it's Kelly that is the one to scare them off.
It doesn't make sense. You came there to see her. She is the waitress.
Yeah. The scene just doesn't work.
I mean, it worked in my mind.
Oh?
If the intention was to show that these people are idiots, then yes, it worked quite well.
But do you feel like we revisit that? Was this a trait that these characters needed? Because they just kind of seem to be aspiring filmmakers, maybe not highly educated in how film works, or well-learned, if you will, but this just seemed out of character for them, to me.
Maybe that's what they're trying to do. Maybe they're just trying to show exactly how, like, fish out of water they are. They're filmmakers, but they're making a film about something that they do not belong in.
Okay. I will go along with that. I guess, yeah, that does make sense, because it's kind of compounded in the next scene where Leslie is waiting for them at the van, which I thought was a very good scene, where he plays feeling betrayed so well. He's so angry, and then plays the victim, and then turns violent. And this is, I find, where we really start getting a bit of a, hey guys, this movie isn't what you thought it was, but we're going to play it out a little bit longer. And honestly, I'm sitting here being like, let's go. Let's get to that part of the movie. Let's do that. I think this is also where most of the audience are going to start realize they're being played, because there are so many flip-flops and emotions that don't gel with everything we've seen leading up to this.
Maybe. I know I was just kind of caught up, gassed at, like, Leslie getting almost violent with Taylor in this scene.
Yeah. Yeah, it almost goes very dark. And that's what I'm saying. Like, it's hard to say it's out of character for somebody we don't know, but it's something we haven't really seen.
No, but, like, you get the impression, at least this early on, that he's putting on an act. Like, he can't be this nice. He's a killer, right? So, up until now, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, myself included, were like, just waiting for the, like, when's that other shoe going to drop?
Good point. Taylor confronts Leslie, calling him on his bullshit, and he openly admits to all of it. Also setting up Halloran. And things just start getting chaotic from here. So Todd and Doug argue on film about what Taylor should do. And have you noticed up until, well, later in the film, we still haven't seen Todd or Doug's faces yet?
No, we don't see them until, like, right near the end. And I absolutely did notice that.
The voices and camera movements seem to be enough, though. Did you enjoy that? Or you're like, oh, this is just an interesting creative choice?
I don't know about the camera movements, but definitely the voices were enough, because you could already kind of tell which one's which, right?
Yeah. Disembodied voices that are so good at line delivery that they feel like fleshed out characters, even though you have no idea what they look like. The next morning, they meet up with Leslie and agree to continue the documentary. So he gives them a tour of his house. I have in quotations, his house. And relays his plan for the slaughter. Mixed emotions here. There's some fun stuff, I think, like having the fuse box hooked up to a remote control. But the ability to accurately predict the decisions and reactions of the teens is just flat out impossible.
Yeah, but that's what this movie has been doing up until now.
Yeah, but as the movie's been playing out, we've been getting darker, we've been getting a little bit more realistic. And now it feels like we're jumping back into the fantasy element.
Well, yeah, this is the Home Alone moment.
You're correct. I didn't think of it that way.
It is, I will say this, it was one of the better Home Alone moments that I recall, simply because it doesn't, like, overtly feel like it. They do a good job just kind of like giving you a peek behind the curtain.
Which is this entire film, and I love that. The scene between Taylor and Leslie talking about Kelly and the tool shed, heavy-handed, but there is a theme of gender running through this film. So where Kelly's going to transform from victim to heroine by grabbing a phallic weapon to fight back, in Leslie's eyes, she's stealing his manhood, but he's already sabotaged all the weapons she could use. His meticulous planning is insane. And this goes along with your Home Alone moment, how he's like, there are 11 exits on the main floor, 8, potentially 9 on the second floor.
I've sealed up the windows here and this and that. Like, yeah,
he's rigged trees so branches will break if people try to escape from the second floor. And the rewatch is amazing because you see all of this happen. He's laying out all of the means for Taylor to survive when she becomes the final girl. Now, I think I might even get more out of a third viewing, which I'll probably go back to later today, but I'm really enjoying these hints. Next up, what happens to the kids when they run into the barn? He predicts the arrival of Doc Halloran and then the showdown.
Then
he's going to chase Kelly into the orchard, which Taylor acknowledges to be the womb where Kelly will emerge as a woman born again. I've already mentioned it. Carol Clover's book, Men, Women, and Chainsaws. If you want to get more into this, read that book.
How does he know what time Doc is going to show up?
How does he know any of it? Any of it? And the cider press. It's a fixed element which he needs to get them to go to, and I don't know how he knows he can do that. But as the viewer, we all predict that's where he himself will end up.
I didn't predict it.
You didn't predict that?
No.
Oh, they called it so hard.
I'm sorry. I should have. I'm a wrestling fan. I should have known when you set up a weapon or an obstacle, you're the one that's going to take it.
Yes.
But no, I'm not smart, man.
Chekhov's gun. All right. Well, you are very smart. Trust me. We've been doing this for a long time.
You don't need to reassure me.
I appreciate you and everything you do.
Just stop.
Who's my super smart little guy? Stop it, teacher. Who's my super smart little guy?
This is just going to sound so weird.
You are. You know you are. Anyway. Eugene gives us a quick breakdown of how to survive a slasher. And this is overlaid with wholesome scenes of he and Leslie skipping stones on a lake. My bonding moment. We already know he's the mentor, blah, blah, blah. I do like how it's conveyed as passionate art. And I really enjoyed the reveal that Jamie was Eugene's final girl and they ended up getting married. It makes zero sense.
No, it makes none whatsoever.
But I still really enjoyed it. There's another scene that I thought would get you.
Okay.
And please let me know if I'm wrong, because you're good at that. The conversation at the beginning of Murder Night between Leslie and Taylor, where Leslie is just so happy that he breaks down crying.
That's what he's been working towards, man.
I know. This actor is amazing. But for some reason, I don't know why I thought that would get you.
No, I didn't. I wasn't moved by it.
Has anyone told you you're probably heartless?
No. Well, that took a dramatic turn from the praise that I just got.
I said nothing about intelligence there.
Okay, all right.
Murder Night.
That was a good movie, too.
Of course, everything... We all love Murder Night. Everything goes to plan, somehow. The initial murders of the two kids upstairs, the reactions of the crew, I thought were insanely authentic. But I have to ask you, what did they think was going to happen?
Yeah, that's the part that I was struggling with at this point, because he's been telling them this entire time, this is what I'm going to do. I am going to kill all these people. And it's almost like up until it actually started happening, they didn't believe him. And then the realization hit them like, oh, shit, he's actually killing people.
Yeah, and honestly, that's, I could kind of get behind that. They've already seen him murder the librarian. Why are they shocked that he's actually killing these kids?
They were probably happy with the librarian because they had some overdue books and now they don't have to pay the fine. As for the kid.
That is such garbage.
I don't know. You ask me a question, I give you an answer.
Yeah, it is a major plot hole for me. Or not, maybe not plot hole, but oh, I don't know, man. I can't think of the proper term. We'll go with plot hole.
Okie dokie.
Leslie understands that the crew aren't really cut out to be there and tries to get them to leave.
I really enjoyed this.
I enjoyed it too. Tell me, what did you like about it?
Just because it really buys into the fact that, like, this is the world they live in, and obviously he doesn't want them to take it up on it, which you find out later. But mm-hmm. at this point, it's just like, listen, and we get this from the very start, even when they, like, first meet him, and he was, like I said, you know, giving them the few moments looking out the window, and Taylor's like, I don't understand, like, he invited us, we were on the phone, like, they are completely okay with this and getting the behind the scenes look, and then he's just like, get out of here. Oh man, yeah. If they only took him up on that, I don't know how this would have gone.
Yeah, really though, but it's all part of his plan, he knows they're not gonna leave. But how, like, Todd and Doug just shake hands with them and they all wish each other good luck. This is weird. And Taylor is the only one to try and talk him out of it and does so as she's crying. Here, Sandro, is where everything really takes a turn. One of my favorite parts.
Okay.
Once the crew turns off their cameras, the movie visually transitions from documentary footage to that of an actual slasher film.
Yeah, and now we see the cameraman.
Exactly. Now we get fully fleshed out Todd and Doug faces. They are actual characters now in a slasher film, which none of them realized they were going to be a part of. So now it's the film crew versus Leslie, and which I find very interesting. And I remember loving it the first time I saw it because the crew already know Leslie's entire plan and setup, what to do, what not to do.
They know the plan that he wants them to know. Because exactly. There's a number of times where they try to warn the kids, hey, this is what's going to happen. We need to do the other thing. And that's what he wanted.
The biggest swerve, though, leading into that, is finding out that Kelly is definitely not a virgin.
No. But that should have been the moment when they realized that she's not the survivor girl.
Agreed. That realization comes a little bit too late for me and for you, apparently. But yeah, Taylor does try and warn the kids about what's happening in an attempt to impede Leslie's plans. But he is a genius, I guess you could say. He's already adjusted the plan because the original plan for him was to have the film crew lumped in with the other victims. So a believable move of a character, or do you think this is just some convoluted writing by the screenwriter?
I think there's a couple of flaws in it that you're inevitably going to have to accept. And
yeah.
The intention is definitely to make it look like, you know, Leslie is just a genius. Mm-hmm. In order to get there, you do need to suspend a little bit of disbelief on, like we said, some of those dominoes falling perfectly in place.
Yeah. Do you think that the switch from documentary to slasher film worked for you?
No.
I agree.
I actually would have much rather if this movie just continued as the documentary. I can't even imagine how that would look moving forward, but it mm-hmm. it lost a lot for me at this point.
I feel the exact same way. It went from making fun of everything we've already seen into then just giving us more of what we've already seen. It felt like the first 2/3 of the movie were brilliant and fun and fresh and original. And then we got something that we've seen for 50 years.
I'll be the one to say it then. and also kind of a subpar version of what we've gotten over the last 50 years.
Agreed. And I know we still have a few scenes to get through, but it's hard to ignore the drastic turn in quality. Even though it was intended, I think the intention just kind of fell flat.
Well, you can't do this type of cookie cutter slasher part of the movie after spending the entire movie letting you get to know the villain, his plan, the way his mind works. And it's just like, okay, there's a little bit of how are they going to overcome it because he's got everything planned. But like, it's yeah. just the veil has been lifted too much to enjoy it like a regular slasher movie. It was perfectly fine to enjoy as this mockumentary, but yeah.
Yeah, it's safe to say it lost you, it lost me. It will probably lose a lot of people that actually held on after the shock of it being pretty much a comedy up until now. Not to say there's nothing great about what happens in the end. Todd sacrificing himself, I thought was a brilliant scene. Because one thing Eugene told us earlier is that if you're going to try and survive a slasher, you need to run as far and as fast as you can in plain sight. And he was doing that to distract Leslie from Taylor, from Doug. Oh, wait, sorry, I switched it around. It's Doug sacrificing himself, not Todd. Doug trying to save everyone by distracting Leslie because he knows Leslie can't let one person get away because that person is not the final girl. So that just unravels everything he's trying to do. And yeah, because Leslie has been doing his cardio training, he does catch up. And Doug's trying to reason with his friend, but Leslie is just an insane person and kills him.
I did really like that attempt at pleading with him. Like, come on, man, it's me. It's me, man.
Like, yeah, it was really good. And that was an odd glimmer of hope that maybe what we were watching is actually going to get better. It does not get better. So everyone else retreats to the barn. This is where Taylor realizes Leslie's actual plan. He was the one that tracked her down for the documentary. She didn't find him, which we kind of missed the first time we saw this. And that she has always been his planned final girl. This brings me back to the scene where Taylor asked Leslie if he loved Kelly. And think about his response there. It definitely changes things for me anyway. Of course, he predicted that Doc Hallen will show up. And Todd accidentally knocks him the fuck out with a shovel.
Yeah, come on, Todd.
I thought he would have murdered him. I'm really hoping I got these names right, because I'm feeling like I've mixed up Doug and Todd a few times.
No, I think you have. I'm fairly certain Todd is the one that sacrificed himself, but I didn't want to say anything.
Okay. So Doug has a shovel. Leslie kills off the last two kids, leaving us with Taylor and Doug and the somehow now awake Halloran. That shot to the head with a shovel should have put him down for a while. But Halloran stabbed, Doug is knocked out. Taylor grabs the axe, as again we were told that the final girl would, and heads into the orchard as we were told the final girl would. Exactly the plan. Do you like this orchard scene?
No.
I think it's probably the worst in the entire film.
This movie has dropped off a cliff, man.
Yeah. And thank God it's almost over.
Yeah.
So the final showdown between Killer and Final Girl, Leslie has the upper hand until Taylor stabs him with his own sickle. Then she crushes his head in the cider press, which you didn't see coming somehow.
No, I'm dumb.
Don't make me do that again. Next up, just douse the place in gasoline and burn it to the ground. So we've got Doug, Halloran, Taylor surviving the attacks and regroup, watch the barn burn to the ground. As Halloran assures the others that Leslie was just a man. Then we fade to black, roll credits, and I like that they somehow found enough money to get the rights to use Psycho Killer by the Talking Heads. I did not like that we had to watch the entire credit crawl for the security camera footage of the morgue where Leslie rises up off of his gurney. I get it. It's good to hang around and watch everybody that contributed to making this movie. We should do that with all films. But I was so irritated by the end of it. I'm like, what are we doing here? Where are we going with this? Why are you making me wait? I'm already so annoyed with the drastic turn this film took, and now you're just making me wait, which is one thing I hate more than anything in the world.
There was a post-credit scene?
It was an entire credit scene.
Yeah, you know me. I don't stick around.
Yeah, it was just that grainy black and white footage. And at the very end of the credits, Leslie rises up, sitting up on the gurney.
I really need to start watching our movies through to the end.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
This is probably never going to happen, man.
I know. So, having watched this now, seeing a change in camera quality, in, I would say, acting, because in the first part, when it's still the mockumentary, I feel like Taylor, Todd, and Doug act differently than they do when it turns into the legit slasher film. So they definitely have to hire some talented actors here. We got Robert Englund. A Kane Hodder cameo is great, but I don't know how much he charges. You got Scott Wilson, Zelda Rubinstein. How much do you think this movie cost?
$15 million.
It was very hard to track down the budget because it's not reported on any website. So I had to go into a few different interviews with the director. Apparently, he said it cost around $800,000.
Oh, wow.
So the physical production was $250,000. The cast, which caught me off guard, including Englund, cost only $130,000.
Wow.
The post-production was another $250,000 because they had to marry two types of film stock and make it look proper, right? When you go from that handheld documentary footage into the slasher footage, you need two cameras, two different cameras. You need two different types of film stock. And this leaves just under another $200,000, which I assume was marketing. I don't know. I don't remember anything about this movie before it showed up on the shelf at the store. So it makes sense. It didn't really get very much advertising. So how much money did it make, Sandro?
I don't know. Did this movie even go into theaters?
Maybe a few.
100,000?
69,136.
Yeah. I'm not surprised by it. I'd never heard of it. Like, was there even any marketing for this movie? I don't know.
Yeah, I really don't know. It's a shame. I think a lot more people should have seen that. But that does take me into the reviews. And the reviews do not reflect the gross of the film.
Okay.
What do you think it's sitting at out of 10 on IMDb?
The way you say that makes me think it's a lot higher than it should be. 7.4.
6.7.
Okay.
Rotten Tomatoes, I think the critics gave it. Percentage of positive reviews.
58.
76.
Okay.
I find that very surprising. Audience score?
71.
75.
Okay. It's all kind of in the same range, which you rarely see between critics and fans.
Exactly. So there is a positive viewing of the film, but it made no money. I think we're going to talk about why it didn't make money. But first, let's get into the awards.
Alrighty, who did you have as your least favorite character?
This is a tough one.
Okay.
It really was. Because honestly, for the most part, I liked everybody. So I had to pick Kelly, played by Kate Johnson. She was fine. Her acting was fine. But the character just grated on me by the end of the movie. Like, you were on her side while it was a mockumentary, but as soon as it went slasher, she just irritated the shit out of me. You?
I had Angela Gothals or whatever it is as Taylor.
Okay.
I didn't care for her.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, no, I didn't like her.
Any reason?
I feel like during the course of the mockumentary, she was way too naive. And then when it became too real, she was too stupid, even though she was given all of the information. I just didn't like this character.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about it that way. That does make sense.
She was just falling on her face the entire time.
What about your favorite character?
This was super easy. It was Nathan Basil?
Basil.
Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
As Leslie. This guy was phenomenal. He played a creepy character. He played a charming character. He was fantastic. I think that he ended up being like the perfect cast for this role. I have no idea who this guy is. I don't know what else he's done or where he's from, but he was phenomenal in this.
He has not done much. I looked into it. I agree with you, though. He is also my favorite character. Leslie is great. Nathan did such an amazing job from the get-go up until the very end. He stole the entire film. And I really kind of wish that they followed through with their plans for a sequel, but obviously with making almost no money, we're not getting that.
I wouldn't have done a sequel, though. You can't start a sequel in the mockumentary form, and the other part was the part that sucked. So,
yeah, I don't know how they would go about it.
Yeah.
I'm curious, though.
I guess maybe a shaky cam, like a lost camera footage one, could work for a sequel, but I wouldn't recommend it anyway.
Yeah.
What was your favorite or most memorable line?
It's when Leslie is talking about nailing all of the main floor windows shut. And Taylor brings up, just going, don't they just smash them out? And he looks perplexed and just goes, you'd think so, but you'd be surprised. No. And they just move on from there. I love that because it sums up everything about this movie that I love. It's identifying problems in slasher films, calling them out for being idiotic, and then just being like, that's how it is. That's how we roll. On to the next one. What about you?
So it was one of the preparation scenes. I'm drawing a blank right now. I think it was the library one when he's talking about planting the microfiche.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, it's not obviously this picture. This is a copy I made. The other one's already there. And I don't remember if it was Todd or Doug. It's like, oh, like one of those baking shows where the pie is already in the oven? The line is pretty good, but what really like makes it is that Leslie's reaction is to just stare at him until he awkwardly turns the camera away. Because like he delivers that line with almost like an excitement. Like he's like, oh, I'm catching on. I get how this is working. And then he's just like, come on. So good.
Doug and Todd were hilarious in this movie.
Oh, yeah. They don't get enough shine.
No. Memorable scene.
You know what this is. Come on, man.
I don't know. I've got two that I'm trying to pick one. It's tough.
The second I saw it, I'm like, this is my scene. This scene was put in the movie for me. And it's the cardio scene. Like, I'm like, yeah. I saw that. And I'm like, it's going to be tough for anything coming up in this movie to top that, because it's like they wrote this for me. So good.
I really like the scene where the crew celebrates after working together to scare the shit out of Kelly at the diner. I really do enjoy that. But I think I'm going to have to go with Leslie preparing for murder night, where he and Taylor are talking about Kelly. And she asks him, you love her, don't you? And he says, I love the idea of her, of what I hope she'll find within herself. And Taylor follows it up with, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. This is a good scene on its own, but on a rewatch, it's so much more impactful because you realize he's actually talking to Taylor about Taylor, but she thinks he's talking about Kelly. I thought it was very good, and I'm going to have to go with that for a memorable scene.
Oh, yeah. As usual, we go in very, very opposite directions here.
I mean, that's fine. We don't have to agree on everything.
I figured you would know that would be mine, because it just spoke to me.
Yeah, in retrospect, it does make perfect sense.
All right, so what were your final thoughts on Behind the Mask?
2/3 awesome, 1/3 trash. I do enjoy this movie more than I dislike it. The first 2/3 is just so good. It feels fresh, original, even almost 20 years after its release. The acting is phenomenal. It's just that switch in the third act, going from documentary to slasher film, while it looks very good, it kind of makes me feel like it's insulting our intelligence, because it told us everything that it was making fun of and then followed up with what it was making fun of. We don't need that. Being a horror fan, I can kind of look beyond that, but I can only imagine that if somebody who wanted to watch a horror movie because they're not really into it and they want to try something different, this could probably just turn them off of the genre altogether. So is it a recommend? If you like horror movies and haven't heard of or have seen this movie, yes. But if you're not really a big horror fan, I think you can easily skip this one. What's your take?
No, this is absolutely not a recommend movie, not even a little bit. If you're a horror fan, the first two thirds are going to turn you off, and those are the best parts. And if you're not a horror fan, that third part is going to be so bad. And I need to stress, to me, it was so incredibly unwatchable that it's going to ruin the enjoyment of the first two halves, because I love the first two halves. I want to see the whole movie like that. There was so
the
much
first two halves
or two thirds.
I'm sorry.
You've just taken the wind out of my sails.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yeah, that's it. Don't recommend it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So that's our thoughts on Behind the Mask. If you guys want to share your thoughts with us, you can hit us up on social media. We're on Twitter at BS Bargain. Oh, I guess it's not Twitter anymore. We're on X at BS Bargain Bin, Facebook.com/BS Bargain Bin, BSBarganBin.com, and the comment section of YouTube.com/@BS Bargain Bin. Ben,
yeah,
what's going on next week, man?
Next week, we'll be covering the new listener pick. This one submitted and won the poll. It's Cody's pick. Originally released in 94 as Drunken Master 2, but released in North America 6 years later with a different title, we will be watching what we know as 2000's The Legend of Drunken Master.
It takes perfect timing, expert training, and years of practice to become a master. But for this master,
here you go!
It only takes one drink to become invincible.
Ah, drunken boxing.
You get up!
Down the hatch!
No more drinking!
But now...
Charge!
When an international gang of terrorists... threaten to steal a nation's treasure. To take them on, he's got a tie one on.
Don't worry, it gives him power.
Oh, good stuff!
Uh-oh.
For this master, it's last call for the final brawl. Jackie Chan, The Legend of Drunken Master.
Until next time, have a good one.
All the best.